This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymeyer. On this week's program, surviving on what others throw away. A day in the life on the West Bank.
The Israeli garbage is definitely much better and much more precious. A shoe from an Israeli garbage is better quality and therefore will bring more money in the market.
Plus, an American finds hospitality in Iran. And beauty on the beach, meet Haiti's little boat builder.
Larry Vaux fits a tiny wooden mast the size of a toothpick on his sanded boat. He's glued on tiny fixtures, pieces of an old watch he found. The sails are made from little scraps from an old white shirt.
Welcome to the World Vision Report. First, this hour's news. Welcome to the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymeyer. Americans are reeling with the news of the economic meltdown in this country. Banks collapsing, stocks plunging, credit disappearing. The crisis has spread to Asian and European markets as well. But the ripples don't end there. Eventually, the credit crisis will have a serious effect on the poor in the developing world. That's according to John MacArthur. He's the head of Millennium Promise, an organization whose mission is to end extreme poverty in Africa. I asked him what he was most worried about in the wake of the bailout.
The markets of, say, the United States or even China and East Asia are buying a lot of products from the rest of the world. They're exporting to these markets. And if the markets are closing down to buy the products from the developing countries, that's a huge concern. If the investment slows down to build the new factories, to pave the new roads, that's a concern.
So is there concern in Africa right now that there may be a decrease in aid headed their way because of this crisis?
Absolutely, I think so. And I think there's a couple things on that. One is that they've seen how much money is injected into the U.S. economy in an emergency situation. Of course, we've seen the $700 billion package. We saw that the Wall Street bonuses this year, at the beginning of this year, even while presiding over the crisis, were over $30 billion. And the commitments to Africa are the same amount. But at the same time, that aid level for Africa has been quite flat over the past couple of years, despite all of the broad rhetoric and promises. And there is a concern that it might not only not be fulfilled, but that it might actually even decrease amidst this. And that's a huge concern for hundreds of millions of people.
And what would it actually mean on the ground, let's say, in a village in Africa?
I think it's first important to put into perspective the United States' share of the foreign aid to Africa, for example. Today, it's approximately $5 billion a year. So it's actually much smaller than is often assumed. That includes the emergency food aid. That includes the technical consultants from Washington to go and give advice. That includes the president's AIDS treatment program, which has really taken off in the past couple of years. And the growing, early stage, but really quickly growing malaria control program. Now, one of the things that's happened this summer is that the Congress approved a $48 billion plan to expand healthcare in Africa over 5 years. So this would be basically, roughly speaking, doubling the annual flow altogether just for health. That is a major step forward, and I think it's anchored in the success of the AIDS treatment program, where we now have basically 2 million people on treatment in Africa for AIDS, whereas just 6 years ago, we really didn't have anyone with any external support. We've seen tens of millions of anti-malaria bed nets distributed in the past just couple of years. We've seen 30 million children in school who weren't in school, primary school, at the turn of the decade. So we've seen tremendous success. Any scaling back on that support would mean literally less malaria control, less medicine available in a general level, life and death issues for, again, millions of people at a very low cost.
Now, John, some people listening to this might think, oh my gosh, I'm losing my 401k, my can't pay for my house. Why would I be so concerned about bailing out Africa? This is not the time to be worrying about Africa. We can barely hold on to our own pensions.
It's a bit of a false choice to say, why should we do that when we have so many problems at home? For a couple of reasons. One, it's so cheap. We're able to muster $10 billion a month for a war in a country that is a real debate at this stage, while we're only mobilizing $5 billion a year for support for 700 million people in a continent. And I think this time of fragility that we're feeling here is, if anything, a reminder of our common fate. We can be thankful that as much as this is an extremely difficult time for countless families in our own rich countries, we're looking at, for example, tens of thousands of jobs, or hundreds of thousands of jobs, rather than hundreds of thousands of lives or tens of millions of lives. I think that we can all be proud that, you know, this is a time when we can both take care of ourselves and take care of supporting the commitments that we have for the rest of the world.
John MacArthur, thanks so much for speaking with us today.
Thank you.
John MacArthur is CEO and Executive Director of Millennium Promise. He spoke to us from a studio in New York City. Outgoing Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert gave a farewell interview to an Israeli newspaper last week. In it, he said that in exchange for peace, Israel should withdraw from most of the territory it occupies on the West Bank. That would be welcome news to the Palestinians who live there, like Forrest Rabaya. He used to work in Israel, hawking vegetables in open-air markets or chopping them in hotel kitchens. But for security reasons, Israel has stopped workers like Rabaya from entering the country. So he's had to find another way to make a living. From the West Bank, Matt Gutman reports.
It's a cold and gray morning as Faris Rabaya gets ready for work. While his wife rouses their six kids, he splashes himself with water from a bucket on the floor.
I scrub myself in order to get rid of the terrible stench. It's always in my nose.
For the past 6 years, the 32-year-old has worked as a scavenger at the municipal dump that Israeli settlers use. He's got to get there early to get the best trash. With jobs scarce in ramshackle West Bank towns, the Israeli dump is one of the few ways Palestinians can make a living. The barrel-chested Rabaya and four friends climb into the ancient pickup they share. It takes a few minutes for him to coax the engine to life. They head out across the rocky hills. They're forced to take spine-jarring goat tracks. For security reasons, the main roads are reserved for Israeli settlers. They're mostly devout Jews living in cloistered communities nearby. Rabaya watches them as they whiz by on the main road.
This life that I'm living is worse and more painful than death. Every day I sink further into difficulties and exhaustion.
Every day at the dump, the Palestinian scavengers wage a war for the choicest trash. Rabaya's knuckles are scarred from fistfights with other scavengers. He has a baseball-sized scar on his shoulder where a rival impaled him with a steel rebar. As we near the dump, tidy red-roofed communities pop up on the ridgeline. Begrudgingly, Rabaya acknowledges that without the settlers and their garbage, he wouldn't have much.
Every time we tried to leave the garbage dump and find a new life, we lost money and lost time. We went to Bethlehem to collect iron and steel and got chucked out. The Palestinians there need the money to live, too. At this point, the only thing we have is the Israeli garbage dump.
At the dump, a tiny Palestinian flag flaps on a pike. Indeed, despite claims of sovereignty, no Israeli settler would set foot here. The stench of rotting food intermingled with chemicals sears your nostrils. Dozens of soot-covered children prowl the trash, all waiting for the next dump truck. When it arrives, they charge. Some hang on to the truck's hatch as it lifts up to spew at its contents. Children and adults stand hip-deep in trash and begin to sort out anything of value. For Rabaya, today's catch consists of a few ratty mattresses.
There's aluminum here too, which has good price, but this is not a single day's work.
He dumps the mattresses, the skeleton of a desk chair, and some tin cans in the back of his truck. He'll drive to a nearby village to sell the trash. Today's haul will yield about $12. In an average month, Rabai earns enough to buy pita bread, vegetables, and a little meat for his large family. The rest goes to buy diesel for his truck. It's Friday here in the West Bank, market day, and a day of prayer. So Rabaya heads back home. His work is actually a family business. One of the kids pumps water into the washing machine, and Rabaya's wife, Noor, turns the rickety machine on. Today she's washing old shoes. They were also found at the dump.
The Israeli garbage is definitely much better and much more precious. A shoe from an Israeli garbage is better quality and therefore will bring more money in the market.
Life for the Rabaya family wasn't always this way. Like hundreds of thousands of Palestinians, Rabaya used to work in Israel. He made decent wages, enough to start building this house in the late 1990s. But the Intifada and the Israeli restrictions it provoked put an end to all of that. The family's house, a gray concrete box, has a gaping hole where the second floor would have been. Noor's not happy about her husband's line of work. She comes from a middle-class family and never expected to be the spouse of a garbage scavenger.
This business is dangerous because the kids are confronted with all kinds of dangerous material. Faris, their father, brought some brass and some glass items to sell. The kids, of course, went to see what that is, and one of the pots broke. And she had 3 stitches, and we had to take her to the hospital. Instead of eating that day, we had to put the money at the hospital.
Still, Noor is proud of her husband's ingenuity. Back inside the house, some of the kids play a small Yamaha flute. It was retrieved from the dump, just like the family's washing machine, TV, and satellite receiver, all picked out, then painstakingly repaired. Rabai has even dabbled in computers.
I fixed a Pentium 3. I made it work in Arabic. I used it for a while and then sold it for parts in the market.
Rabaya says there's very little that can't be salvaged. He tries to remain hopeful that one day the settlements will be dismantled, the barriers will be lifted, and the Palestinian economy will thrive. He used to dream of opening a hardware store. But Rabaya, like most Palestinians, feels it'll be a long time before the settlers leave. And the dream to open a store? Well, he says, waving his hand at me, that'll probably remain a dream. For the World Vision Report, I'm Matt Gutman in Yatta, the West Bank.
Just ahead, bloggers take on poverty. Stay with us on the World Vision Report. Welcome to the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. To introduce the next story, I wanted to do some research. So I went online and typed in the word blog. This is what came up on blogger.com. A blog is a personal diary, a daily pulpit, a political soapbox, a breaking news outlet. You get the idea. Since blogs were launched in 1999, they've shaken up politics and journalism, and they've given thousands of ordinary people a voice. It's not just happening in the U.S. Richard Locke reports from Lagos, Nigeria.
In a hot, humid cyber cafe called the Golden Nets, 23-year-old Jennifer Ehidiaman sits at a row of old computers and updates her blog.
Is it really possible? Can we have the emergence of a generation that has less of HIV-infected people? So I decided to carry out a public...
Jennifer's a journalism student. She launched her blog, Youth Make a Change, in 2006.
Okay, when I first started blogging in 2006, all I had on my blog was just poetry, pictures. But in 2007, as I grew more matured in terms of, well, journalism, I thought I could put other more serious issues on the blog. So I see my own blog as a platform through which I could raise issues affecting young people, like an average young person in Nigeria.
Issues such as poverty and corruption, but also more light-hearted subjects such as sport and fashion. blogs are taking off across Africa as a tech-savvy generation takes advantage of easier access to the internet. Until recently, the only people filling the Nigerian blogosphere were Westerners living in the country. But increasingly, young Nigerians like Jennifer are using blogs to voice their opinions. The reason, Jennifer says, is because blogs are safe.
You can decide to like open a blog anonymously and get put anything on it, and nobody will come looking for you because it's just there on the internet.
Although the era of military dictatorship here is over, people still mistrust politicians. Another reason for the popularity of blogs, censorship. Many African governments keep a tight control on the media. So in places like Ethiopia and Sudan, blogs are emerging as an essential tool to criticize the government and highlight injustices. Although the press in Nigeria is now considered relatively free and fair, some people still believe the government interferes over what's published. That's why Samuel Esichi turns to blogs.
Oh, this is a very good topic. This is kind of new. The story here is about cement.
The 22-year-old says he finds it easier to identify with bloggers who tend to be from his generation.
A large number of people that blog are young people. And they give you
a large number of people who blog are young people, and they give you the news the way that they are. And they are fun, too, because they write in language or terms that are suitable to you that you can easily understand or relate to. And this I find very catchy.
In Nigeria, blogging is slowly giving a voice to the voiceless. People who previously wouldn't have any way to express their thoughts on issues like poverty, corruption, and poor governance. But blogging in Nigeria, and indeed Africa, does have its limitations.
Blogging only gives a voice to people in the cities.
26-year-old Stephen Oguntoyinbo, a passionate blogger, explains why.
The rural areas, there's no access for them because they don't have the infrastructures. The computers are not there, the internet facilities are not there for them to start blogging.
And for many, the cost of going online remains prohibitively expensive.
It is no longer news that while some people are complaining of inadequate basic amenities such as good road.
Back at the Golden Net Cyber Cafe, blogger Jennifer Ahidi-Aman reads over a previous entry. She firmly believes she and other bloggers can influence her country's politicians.
We can all, as individuals, really use this channel.
In Jennifer's words, it's no use moaning about the injustices of life when blogging allows you to do something about it. For the World Vision Report, I'm Richard Locke in Lagos, Nigeria.
October 15th is a big day for bloggers wherever they are in the world. It's Blog Action Day. It's an annual event where thousands of people meet online to discuss one issue and share ideas about the best way to tackle the problem. Last year, the subject was the environment. This year, it's poverty. Sayan Taid is the coordinator of Blog Action Day 2008. She joins us from Montreal. Welcome to the show, Sayan.
Thanks, Peggy.
Every year, you concentrate on a single topic, and this year the focus is poverty. Why poverty and why now?
We found that with the situation in Darfur, all the things that are happening in the world, it was an issue which is extremely pressing. We also felt that with the UN Millennium Campaign, there are a whole load of commitments that were made towards solving poverty by the year 2015, and we're nowhere near there. And so we thought, well, we really should just take the time to get everybody together and focus on this issue today.
So how do you get people to submit blogs on poverty? Will these be your regular bloggers, or will more bloggers sign on because of the topic? How does it work?
Well, it started out a grassroots thing. A few bloggers got together, myself included, and said what would happen if we all posted about the same topic on the same day. And we wrote an email out to a few friends who were also bloggers, and suddenly a huge number of bloggers all said, well, yeah, we want to get involved in this as well. So what we have now is we have a sign-on page where anyone who has a blog or a podcast or a video cast can go on the site, sign on, just say, I want to be involved, and then on the day post about the issue. So it's really as simple as that.
And I understand, Sayan, that you've already had a few blogs submitted. Any chance you could read us some excerpts from some of your favorite ones?
Absolutely. GetRichSlowly.org, which is a blog about saving and wealth creation. They have 60,000 readers. They're a great blog. They've got a post called What I Can Do to Fight Poverty. And they say, I do not tithe to church or charity. I feel guilty about this. My rationale is always, once I take care of myself, I'll take care of other people. Yet what do I mean by taking care of myself? I don't know. Sometimes I think once I've saved X, then I'll start sharing my wealth. But X seems to be a moving target. I've thought a lot about this over the past couple of weeks. According to the Global Rich List, my wealth places me in the top 1% of the world population, and that will likely increase as I get older. I have enough. The time has come for me to learn to share, but how? Now, that came from JD on GetRichSlowly.org, and what's incredibly exciting is that so many money blogs have gotten involved this year, and usually what they're saying to their audiences is, here's how to invest, here's how to make more money. And just for today, they're turning around and say, okay, here's how you can give something back. So that's really great. There's another post from skellywag.org, which is a post about technology blogging and online business. And her post is called 30 Simple Ways to Battle Poverty with Technology. And she has a lot of ideas. One of them is, if you like the idea of helping out but are just strapped for time, why not just contribute $10 to a low-interest loan for an entrepreneur in the developing world? She also suggests donating unneeded items on eBay or Craigslist and donating the proceeds to battling poverty, or giving a poverty-battling organisation some free advertising on your blog or website. So as you can see, there is all really small things. They wouldn't take much time, but if everybody started doing them, then it would hopefully make a really positive difference.
Yeah, they're very practical suggestions. What do you hope to accomplish by doing this?
Well, I think there is a temptation to feel like everything's just too hard, it's too complicated, we don't know what to do, and to say, okay, just for today, I'm going to think, how could I make a difference here? What little thing could I do? Could I buy fair trade? Could I support one laptop per child? Tiny things people can do that if everybody started doing them would all make a difference. So we're not saying that obviously a whole bunch of bloggers posting about the issue of poverty on Blog Action Day is going to be the thing that ends poverty. But we're hoping that by doing this, we're adding to a global momentum. Everybody's trying to head there anyway. It's just everybody needs to do their part.
All right. Thank you, Sayan Tayeed, for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, Peggy.
Sayan Tayeed is co-founder of Blog Action Day. She joined us from Montreal. And you can join the conversation on October 15th by visiting our website, worldvisionreport.org. Many Mexicans are fed up with the way their politicians handle government business. That's why some say they refuse to pay their taxes. In fact, Mexico's tax revenue is only about 8 or 9% of its GDP, one of the lowest in the world. That's because much of the country's economy is known as the informal economy, improvised markets and walking street vendors who earn small sums every day and are notoriously tricky to tax. From Banderilla in southern Mexico, Conrad Fox has this story.
It's about 10 o'clock in the morning, and business is already going well at the stall of Esteban Cortez. He sells an odd combination of sandals and hotcakes. Competition is stiff in the sandal business these days, with more and more people turning to street selling to make a living. So a few years back, he added a skillet and started selling the popular snack as well. He says it was hard to admit that footwear sales just weren't cutting it.
At first I felt kind of embarrassed. It's like you've stepped down in the world, you know? Your clients laugh at you, your friends, your family, but then they see it's a good business. Well, now, embarrassed? Me? They all want my recipe.
There's something else he's not embarrassed about either.
I'm a tax evader. I've never paid and I never intend to.
And neither do most of the estimated 20 million other street vendors in Mexico. Jorge Smecki is a professor of business administration at Mexico City's Iberoamericana University. He says street vendors like this one have been a blessing and a curse for Mexico.
The informal economy is like a social shock absorber, because the formal economy doesn't create enough new jobs every year. But the problem is, it's not taxed. There's no system. A typical market is 500 stalls, and they're not always the same. How do you know who's there? You've got the famous bullfighters, they're called. They lay out their products on a cloth on the ground. When the inspector comes, they just whip up the cloth like a matador and run away.
And that, he says, means about $3 billion in lost tax revenue for the country.
The truth is, very few Mexicans are paying taxes. It makes the country unsustainable. There's no way 30% of us can pay for the other 70%.
Today, some 40% of the country's tax revenue comes from the state-owned oil company. But many analysts predict Mexico's oil and the taxes that go with it could run out in just 10 years. That has politicians scrambling to tax street sellers. 2 years ago, they implemented a simplified version of the country's tax system for small business people like street vendors, charging a flat fee of about $22 every 2 months. But Esteban Cortez, the vendor who sells hotcakes, says even that is too much.
No recibimos ningún beneficio.
We don't get anything for it in return. We've got no place to sell, no social security. Sure, taxes pay for stuff like hospitals, but have an accident and see how much they charge you for an operation.
Doña Jolie earns about $400 a month selling food at the same market as Cortez. She says that when a family member gets sick, she has to go from stall to stall asking for help.
It's in God's hands. What the other sellers will chip in is all you've got.
She says she does pay her taxes, but only grudgingly.
It's not fair. I've got to pay property tax, electricity, water. I come here in a taxi, and imagine how much is left for me in the end. Nothing.
Mexico's president, Felipe Calderón, has vowed to find a way to make street vendors pay taxes. But Cortez says it'll have to be politicians that make the first move. They're so corrupt, he says. Why should I pay my taxes just so they can steal the money? For the World Vision Report, I'm Conrad Fox in Banderilla, Mexico.
In Mexico, 50 cents a week can buy a sense of security. Here's our globe at a glance. You don't need a credit check, but you do have to be an adult with an income, even if it's very small. It might sound like a subprime mortgage, but it's not. It's micro life insurance, and it's become quite popular in Mexico. For as little as 50 cents a week, poor Mexicans can buy peace of mind. Policies worth $1,000 to $9,000 are being sold at banks and furniture stores. They're written in simple language so everyone can understand them. When the policyholder dies, the family gets a lump sum of money. Poor families often face financial ruin when a loved one dies. The goal of microlife insurance is to make sure that doesn't happen. And that's our globe at a glance. I'm Peggy Wehmeyer, and this is the World Vision Report. There's been much discussion in the run-up to the election about whether the U.S. should talk to Iran. Relations with Iran have been tense for years. So when reporter Will Everett recently visited Tehran as a tourist, he wondered what sort of reaction he'd get from the Iranian people.
My friends thought I was crazy. After all, they hate us over there, don't they? I told them I'd be fine, but my friends had misgivings. They said, "Watch out, this trip won't be a walk in the park." That got me thinking. Since the Islamic Revolution 30 years ago, when the bars and discos were all shut down, most Iranian social life has gone behind closed doors. But I'd heard that if you want to meet Iranians, a walk in the park would be a good place to start. Tehran has 800 parks to choose from. I chose Jamshidi Park for my stroll because I'd heard it was popular, especially at night. When I got there, it was 11 p.m. on a weekend and music blared from snack shops. The park was filled with families. I found them reclining on picnic blankets, playing badminton and smoking water pipes. I wanted to meet these people. I was with my Iranian friend Farishte. I asked her, "How do I start up a conversation with an Iranian?" She taught me several pleasantries in Persian.
Another word you can say, khosh migzare. Khosh migzare.
Khosh migzare.
Exactly.
This is the polite thing to say to an Iranian who is eating. It means basically bon appetit. So as I walked past these picnickers, I offered them my best hosh migzare. They were already looking at me with puzzled expressions as I walked by. But when they heard hosh migzare, their ears perked up. Not only was I a Ferengi, or foreigner, I was trying to speak their language.
Your accent is native.
Oh, thank you.
Right, this makes perfect.
The men in these reclining groups would then stand, beckoning me with outstretched arms to join them on their picnic blanket. The wives or grandmothers would grab a plate and start filling it with steamy basmati rice, lamb kebabs, tomatoes drenched in olive oil, and fresh fruit.
Do you like watermelon?
Watermelon?
Yes. Do you like?
Yes.
Yeah.
They poured cup after cup of tea. They asked me to try the water pipe, laughing when I gagged on the strong smoke. They wanted to know where I lived. Did everyone ride a horse in Texas? Were the parks there as nice as this one? I was ashamed to say that I'd never venture into a big city American park at 11 p.m., and I certainly wouldn't be accepting food from a stranger. Nearly everyone wanted to know, what do Americans think of us? When I told them what my friends back home had said about the dangers awaiting me here, they couldn't believe it. One woman, seated in a group near a fountain, said, "Tell them we're enjoying our lives. Just look at us, as if we had no care in the world." As Farishte and I went from blanket to blanket, the words Hosh Migzare were like the open sesame that opened the hearts and hospitality of the Iranians we met. I must have eaten three or four meals in the 2 hours we were there. I returned to Jamshedi Park many times during my month in Iran, though not at dinner time. I might have saved a lot of money on food, but I didn't want to abuse their hospitality. It would probably be a long time before they saw another American strolling through Jamshedi Park, and I didn't want to make a bad impression.
Will Everett is a freelance reporter based in Texas. Coming up, pirates make waves off the coast of Africa. Stay with us. This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. Welcome back. Last week, the story of pirates seizing a ship full of tanks and weapons captured the imagination of the public. Surprised to hear that pirates are still around? In fact, pirate attacks are not uncommon off the coast of Africa. On the West Coast alone, hundreds of millions of dollars are lost each year to pirates. It's just one of the problems traditional fishermen there face. Nico Columban caught up with two fishermen from Guinea's seaside capital, Conakry, in West Africa.
Soriba Kamara has trouble starting up the old engine on his small wooden, brightly painted boat he calls Faith. After a few tries, he finally gets his boat going, setting out across the first break of waves. He's looking for fish called Le Capitaine in French, meaning captain, and another fish he calls Rebel, because it has teeth. These are local species meant for the local market. Bigger fish like tuna are caught by foreign-operated industrial boats and immediately exported out of Guinea. Kamara shouts instructions to his three-man crew while they cast nets they spent hours repairing themselves. Kamara doesn't have any money to buy new nets.
New nets cost 10 million Guinean francs, or about $2,000. There is no way we can afford them. A new motor will cost between $3,000 and $4,000. We have too many problems, and there are fewer and fewer fish. We are traditional fishermen who cannot go very far into the water. Our area is overfished by much bigger foreign boats, which have more equipment on board, and which are more sophisticated.
Back on shore, he sells fish to market women who act as barterers between fishermen and wholesale buyers. It's a complicated process in which profits for the fishermen dwindle. But Kamara, who's got seven kids, says he has no choice.
I fish just to help my family survive. If I don't fish, I cannot feed my children. It's just for survival.
Kamara also faces the constant threat of attacks from pirates. Guinean newspapers have weekly reports of fishermen being injured and sometimes even killed at sea.
These boats come in to attack us and steal our fish. When this happens, the government does nothing to find out who is guilty. It does nothing to compensate the families of the victims. During the last rainy season, pirates attacked a small boat and killed all the crew.
Kamara says he barely survived a similar incident himself. Despite the hardship and danger, Kamara says he wants to persevere as a fisherman.
This is the only activity I have ever known. My father was a fisherman, so I became a fisherman as well, even if it's just for survival. I also want my children to continue fishing, but my sons are also going to school, so I hope they will one day be able to do more modern and industrial fishing than what I'm doing.
At the dock, another fisherman, Mamadou Kamara, no relation to Sariba, is fixing his boat called Have Confidence, but he has little left himself. He says that for his family to survive, his wife has to sell things at the market. He doesn't want his son's fate to be tied to fishing. Rather than going out to sea, some of the fishermen's sons now work like these young men. They're filling ice-filled trucks with fish for export for foreign-owned companies. For the World Vision Report, I'm Nico Columbans in Conakry, Guinea.
From the shores of West Africa, we go now to the seaside of Haiti. There, in the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere, one young man takes things other people have thrown away and uses them to build the stuff of his dreams, small model boats. Reporter Amelia Shaw brings us this latest installment of our Street Vendor series.
In the tiny village of Kaijakmel, a young man sits hunched at a table by the ocean, studying a small piece of wood in his hand. As a hen shoos her chicks under the table, 23-year-old Jean-Campé Larivaux sits at a table with two assistants, who are hammering into chiseled blocks of wood. Larivaux picks up a small saw and begins to cut.
I sit here and try to make sense of myself, my talents, what it is I can do with my life.
It's a big question in Haiti, where unemployment runs 80%. But Larivaux thinks he's found what may very well be a unique trade in Haiti, albeit one that doesn't earn him much money. He rummages through a pile of tools on the table looking for some sandpaper. He says it was after attending carpentry school for a few months that he hit on the idea of making miniature boats.
And despite the obstacles, the problems I have, I knew I could overcome them, that I could do what I wanted to do.
Larivaux sends a 3-inch oblong piece of wood, shaped like a tiny boat. He's been making miniature boats with his friends at this rickety table for the last 4 years. He taught himself to do it, and when he's lucky, someone stops in to buy one.
Sometimes we sell one to Haitians visiting the beach here. Once in a while, even a foreigner comes in. That doesn't happen often, but we get by.
Most visitors come to Kaijakmel for the beach, that deep turquoise sea and white sands of the Caribbean. But as all mariners know, the ocean is as treacherous as she is beautiful.
I live next to the sea. I used to even have a little workshop here. One day there was a storm. The sea rose up, swallowed up my workshop, and took it away. There was nothing left, so we had to start over from zero.
Larivaux fits a tiny wooden mast the size of a toothpick on his sanded boat. He's glued on tiny fixtures, pieces of an old watch he found. The sails are made from little scraps from an old white shirt, tied to the mast with a black thread.
I take things people don't want anymore, the stuff they throw away on the beach. I take it home and I look at it. I consider all the possibilities, and then I use it.
Larivaux folds the mast against the little boat and slips it through the neck of a bottle. The bottle is tipped on its side and is half filled with blue paraffin. he uses a sawed-off clothes hanger to center the boat on the paraffin and lift the mast. When he's done, he's holding a tiny ship, sealed and sailing in a little bottle.
God made all of us intelligent in our own way. If your eyes work, and your ears work, and your mind works, then you can be something. There's no need to wait for someone to come save you. Everyone in this world has a talent.
And for Larivaux, his talent is making little boats in a bottle by the sea. But as he saws wood with his two friends at his work table, it's easy to see what his specialty is. Never giving up. For the World Vision Report, I'm Amelia Shaw in Cajacmel, Haiti.
Amelia tells us that Larivaux survived the hurricanes that hit Haiti this season, but his house was damaged and he's had to move in with his mother. There is some good news. He's had a few commissions, and he's just completed his first model of three boats in a bottle. You can actually see Larivaux's models. We have a slideshow on our website, worldvisionreport.org.
Ruhanga kulimbe.
Laura Kabasomi Kakoma uses music to explore what it is to be an immigrant with ties to two worlds. Somi is the daughter of East Africans, but she was born and raised in Champaign, Illinois. After college, she lived for several years in Kenya and Tanzania. She lives in New York now, but she tours frequently in Africa. Her music is a haunting blend of cultures and languages. She sings in four of them. She calls her style New African Jazz and Soul. A good example is the title track of her latest album, Red Soil in My Eyes.
Ancestors are calling. I can see acacia trees bathing in the river Nile, echoes of my mother's smile.
So pretty. Somi, welcome to the show. Tell us a little, if you would, about this song and what it's about.
Well, Red Soil in My Eyes, really it's about my journey of looking to home. I'm originally from Uganda and Rwanda, but I grew up mostly in the States, in Illinois. And it's really about looking to home, looking to that part of the world, to East Africa, looking to the rhythms, the culture, the music, the stories, the language, and trying to find a sense of clarity and a sense of myself in the music.
Dancing girls with amber in their hair.
Now, you've often said that your music represents a whole new African experience. What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean that what's happening is there's a huge generation, a huge community now of Africans who have been born and raised abroad, who may have been born even in Africa, but then lived most of their lives in the West and have this new African identity. And myself, I'm an African woman who also has a very strong American identity. Part of what I'm trying to do is say that, you know, it doesn't really matter where you're from, whether I'm from Africa or from Europe or from Asia or from wherever, Latin America, or from here. The point is that everybody comes with a story and nobody can really sort of fit into this box.
Now, Your mother's from Uganda. Your father is from Rwanda. They were over here to get educated, and you ended up living mostly here, but obviously you've gone back and forth to Africa. And you say that that experience has really affected your music. What would I hear in your music that illustrates that experience? What would we be listening for?
Well, hopefully you would hear a story of two worlds. Yeah, hopefully you'd hear a story of two cultural influences and sort of what it is to live in between and within both of those cultures. And so hopefully you'd hear some references to like classic American soul and traditional jazz. And then also hopefully you'd hear a lot of the stories of our home in East Africa and hear some of the rhythms. And obviously linguistically, I do sing in a few of the languages in that region.
And I think it'd be fair to say that your song Ingele from the album Red Soil in My Eyes is a good example of that, because you sound like an American jazz singer, but you're actually singing in Swahili. Your mom is from Uganda, and you love Uganda. You've been back there and lived there for a while. But you have a lot to say, and not necessarily positive things, about the role of women in Uganda and how women are treated there. What is it that you talk about when you speak about women there?
Well, it's not so much that I have a lot of negative things to say about how women are treated. I think that women are doing phenomenal things in Uganda. But there are certain policies that are still in place, certain laws that are still in place that are, I think, are incredibly sexist. And one of those issues is that a man still has the right to beat his wife because technically she's considered his property. And if she's to leave him, then she loses her children. He has, you know, there's no, she doesn't have any sort of, she has no rights.
Well, you actually wrote a song, Somi, about this topic called African Lady, and it was a response to your frustration about domestic violence in Uganda. It's also a remake of the song Lady by Nigerian singer Fela Kuti. His song was rather derogatory toward women in a way, and yours is just the opposite. It's speaking up for women, taking the stereotypes away.
Well, his song Lady, I love Fela, but that song Lady isn't so nice to the ladies, right? And he sort of speaks about all these stereotypes of African women, and I thought that I should say something, you know, that was sort of a reclamation of power. I mean, the only thing that's really the same is the chorus, the melody of the chorus. I sort of reference it in my chorus, and that it's Afrobeat.
Don't you know, with a fist your love don't show. Take my hand, let's leave this valley. Use your strength and love to guide me.
You, Somi, you talk a lot about your mother in your music, I assume. She's also has been a great inspiration to you. So much so that you even wrote a song about her called Mbabazi. What does the title mean?
The title is her name, and it means peace in my language, my father's language, Kinyarwanda. And it's just a story about a hardworking woman and a woman who loves just as hard as she works.
Are you up for singing a few lines from it for us?
Sure.
Afitai amaboko arakura. Afitai amaboko arakura ye. Afitai amaboko arakura. Afitai amaboko arakura ye. Afitai amaboko. Arakura. Afitai amaboko arakura.
Somi, thank you so much for joining us today and sharing your music with us.
Thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Brings us to the end of our show. If you want to know more about our program or any of the stories we've featured on the show, check out our website. The address again, worldvisionreport.org. We have a link there so you can podcast the show and listen to it whenever you want. Our production team includes Beverly Abel, Chris Baldiga, Mark Bandy, Doug Boyles, Christina Darden, Cynthia Graber, Lita Hartman, Sue Shepherd, Larry Short, Diane Toomey, and I'm Peggy Waymeyer. Thanks for joining us today.
This program is produced with funding from World Vision. The views expressed in this show are not necessarily those of the organization.